This is an ABC podcast.
In the vast expanse of the Pacific Ocean, where the deep blue waters stretch to the horizon, a battle is quietly unfolding beneath the waves.
Most of them would say that the ocean is too warm. One of them would say that he's a spear gun fisher and they would go out at midnight, but the ocean would be too warm and there would be no fish around.
The mighty tuna, a cornerstone of the Pacific's food chain and economy, is facing a threat like never before.
So we're looking 25 years into the future as a kind of indicator of where things are going. The results so far suggest that the abundance of tuna in the Pacific is going to decline.
Rising ocean temperatures, acidifying seas, and shifting currents are pushing tuna stocks into unfamiliar waters, leaving Pacific Island nations and their fishing industries in peril. Hi, I'm Scott Whitey, and this is Polytalk, where I'll take you behind the scenes of Pacific politics and how it affects us. I'll speak with the politicians from across the Pacific region and with everyday people about political experiences that shape us. Today on Polytalk, the tuna fisheries industry is big business for Pacific countries and is a source of food security. Over the years, countries have negotiated and collaborated about how to overcome issues like overfishing. But now a danger that is out of their control looms in the distance. So what impact is climate change having on tuna in the Pacific? And how is the region preparing for what's to come?
People of Palau have been part of the ocean since creation. One of the questions that we ask a fisher is, what is your relation to the ocean? And most of them would answer that their relationship to the ocean is that it is their responsibility to care for the ocean.
Anne Singeo is the executive director of the Ebil Society, a conservation group committed to the sustainability of Palau's natural resources. And she explains that as part of her work, she interviews local fishermen and women about their connection to the ocean.
I remember at first when the first person answered the question that way, I thought, maybe we need to rewrite the question. I thought certainly someone would say that it provides food for them, that it is a place of recreation, something that provides for them. But after the third interview, the fourth, the fifth, the same answer kept coming up, and they keep defining their relationship to the ocean as their responsibility to care for it. I think that is overall how Palauans see themselves.
Fishing is also deeply woven into her own life.
I actually grew up trawling with my dad. That's my preferred fishery. I like trawling because I grew up doing that with my father. And then I married a man who also is an avid fisher for tuna, billfish, pelagic fish. It's been hard to find somebody in Palau who does not have a very specific relation to the ocean. We always say that in Palau, you have to teach your children how to swim first, even before they can run, because there's so much water surrounding us that if we fall into the water.
But in the past few years, the ocean waters that are usually so familiar to the people of Palau have started to feel different.
You know, you have a fisher someone who grew up in a community of fishers and has become one of the referred to elders in his own community as a knowledgeable fisher. And for him to say that he doesn't know anymore, he doesn't understand what is happening with, like one of them says, I'm confused because right now it's supposed to be the best time for me to go out and get groupers, but I go out there and there is nothing and I just do not understand what is happening, but I guess it's like everything else that's happening around us.
Anne says one fisherwoman told her of a strange weather phenomenon affecting the fish near the coast.
over a week and it rains, heavy rain, instant heavy rain, causes this phenomena where the fish in the shallow waters would just be floating in the water. They would die from lack of oxygen that's being processed in the ocean. And it is a common occurrence in this community. And it was occurring like maybe twice a year. And now they're observing more of that occurring. Even more alarming is that it's no longer happening only in the shallow waters, but it's happening in deeper waters. So they're finding dead fish in the coastal areas. It's because the fish are rotting in the coastline. And it's no longer small fish, but they're sharks and rays and big fish like pollen wrasse and bumphead parrot, even eels that live in hollow areas underneath the corals. So they're seeing things that they've never seen, and they understand that this heat is not just affecting the shallow waters anymore, that it's moving on to the deeper water.
And through research you do at the Ebil Society, how else have you seen climate change impact on Palau?
We have a particular preserve, marine preserve, that we use as a classroom for our students. In Ebil, we work with small communities in environmental restoration work, but we also have a very big component to our work is environmental education and research, social science research. And in this preserve, it's the largest marine preserve in Palau and also the most abundant and productive marine space. There was this typhoon that happened about 2 years ago, and it happened in April, which is not a typhoon season. Typhoon season ends in January. And this is in April when plants and trees are starting to bloom. And so it wiped out our entire fruit season, and it caused this really big effect in the ocean. Later on, we saw that in the preserve there was this outbreak of this bacteria, and it was affecting all the corals, and the corals were dying and was covered with algae. And so we had some marine scientists go out to identify. There was an excessive amount of it in an area that was far away from land, that you wouldn't think that there would be any kind of an affluent from the land that may cause increased bacteria in the ocean.
How did you feel when this happened?
How I felt so helpless. That moment when I jumped in the ocean and I was surprised by what was happening. Because we have also been practicing this theory that if we introduce this concept of conservation, fortress conservation, that prohibited any human activities in the areas, then we would have a greater chance of surviving impact of climate change. And so when the effect of climate change hits the very core of those sort of ideologies, then you just are really thrown off your balance and you wonder if it makes any difference.
How has the impacts of climate change impacted on the cultural knowledge Palauans have of the ocean and fish?
It definitely throws off a lot of what we've learned over time and what we've passed on generationally. The knowledge of the ocean, the observations of nature that has informed their decision making for thousands of years, and how they plan their lives around those natural changes occurring seasonally. And so you'd hear fishers say, I don't understand what's going on. This climate is making me unsure of when I should go out to the ocean or not. It's changing fish behavior that from their own experience. One of the interview, most of them would say that the ocean is too warm. One of them would say that he's a spear gun fisher and they would go out at midnight but the ocean would be too warm and there would be no fish around. Others would say there's this fish runnings for pelagics that they follow. And nowadays, when they go out during what is supposed to be the season, there isn't any fish around. So it's definitely affecting their knowledge of the ocean.
The stories the fishermen and women have told Anne illustrate just how critical the impacts are of a warming climate. Elders with deep knowledge of the ocean say they can no longer rely on it, and that the tuna migration patterns are changing, leaving them empty-handed. These changes are not only a big deal for Palau, but for the whole of the Pacific region. Because tuna fisheries bring in an estimated $500 million annually for the region, which comes from countries selling licenses to industrial fishing companies that trawl Pacific waters.
One of the key things for our region is that it's really abundant in terms of tuna. Our Western and Central Pacific Ocean region provides over 50% of the world's tuna catch, worth a landed value of about $6 billion a year. And the majority of that catch comes from the Pacific Island EZs.
Dr. Graham Pilling is the Deputy Director of the Fisheries, Aquaculture and Marine Ecosystems Division at the SPC, the Pacific Community. And he says while Pacific countries and territories have small landmass, their exclusive economic zones stretch widely into the waters that surround them.
Their 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zones, or EEZs, the areas in which they have exclusive rights on the resources, are huge. To give you an idea, the combined EEZs of the 22 Pacific Island countries and territories that are members of SPC, that's an area of 40 million square kilometers, or over five times the size of Australia.
Dr. Pilling says selling industrial fishing licenses to countries like the United States, Japan, and China is so lucrative for some countries, it props up their economies.
Countries can charge for fishing vessels to access their waters inside their EEZs, and that contributes to government income to pay for infrastructure such as schools, roads, hospitals, that sort of thing. And to give some rough figures, over 70% of the non-aid government revenue in Kiribati comes from the access fees they charge for tuna fishing. And in the territory of Tokelau, it's over 80%. And then on top of that, there's the opportunities for employment in the fisheries sector as fisheries observers, in processing plants and things like that.
Tuvalu is another country where fishing is vital to the economy.
We rely heavily on the fees that we get from distant water fishing nations that fish in our waters. That accounts for about 40% of our government revenue every year. It's between, I'd say, about 35 million to 50 million on a good year.
Simon Kofi is Tuvalu's Minister for Transport, Energy and Communications. He was formerly the Minister for Climate Change and a legal advisor for Tuvalu's Fisheries Department.
One of the success stories of regionalism in the Pacific is how the Pacific nations have come together to really harmonize their laws and their management measures. And the result is that the tuna stock in the Western Central Pacific is the last healthy fish stock in the world.
Minister Kofi, can you explain the work the Pacific has put into achieving this healthy stock of tuna?
Tuna is a migratory fish stock, so it doesn't stay in one EEZ of a particular country. It moves around a lot, and its movement is determined by the environment as well. The temperature of the ocean has an effect on how the tuna moves around in our waters. And so because of this, the region and the sub-region have had to come together to develop conservation and management measures that are consistent across the different countries. I think that the last time I checked it, about over more than 50% of tuna sourced worldwide comes from this part of the world. So it is a very important industry, not just for the Pacific, but for all the different countries that rely on the resource that comes from the Pacific.
One of the key management measures that has helped with this is the Vessel Day Scheme. How does that work?
The Vessel Day Scheme was implemented, I think it might have been 2010 or 2011. And it's a scheme that was adopted by the parties to the Nauru Agreement. whereby fishing days allocated as a sub-region to countries, to member countries, and then those days are then sold to fishing companies. So, and there was also an agreement that the benchmark price for a fishing day is $8,000. So a company would come to Tuvalu and then they would buy, I don't know, 100, 200 days, however many days they want. And once they finish utilizing those days, so every day they spend in our waters fishing, that is one day that they're utilizing. And there is a limited number of days that are assigned to country. And there's also a formula as to how they determine the total allowable effort for the region. And then they assign allocations for parties, what they call party allowable efforts. So that's how they assign days and that's how days are utilized. So once Tuvalu utilizes all its days, we have to close our waters to fishing. So I think this year we have about 2,000 fishing days that we sell to fishing companies.
Despite the many years of work to get to this point, the threat of climate change looms on the horizon. How concerned is Tuvalu about this?
It will have a huge impact. Well, first, on an economic point of view, you know, if we lose out on that revenue that we would normally get, that would have an impact on our budget, sustaining government services, the health sector, education, because that's where that's how we're utilizing the revenue we're gaining at the moment. So it is a concern, and we need to prepare for that as well. I think that there is science that coming out now that is saying that climate change will have an impact on where tuna moves around in the region. So as I said earlier, the tuna follows the temperature of the water as well. So on years where we have the El Nino, the La Nina effect also determines the movement of the tuna. So what they're saying is because of global warming, the oceans are warming up. So the areas where it did not used to move to, where it was too cold for the tuna to travel to, now you have a more dispersed area where the tuna stock is moving around. So that also obviously will have an impact on fishing in this part of the world, particularly this area close to the equator.
Pacific countries like Tuvalu can already see the huge impact climate change will have for their economies and tuna fishing industries. But how is climate change actually affecting the tuna fish itself?
The ENSO cycle, the El Niño Southern Oscillation cycle, which affects the weather, that also affects the conditions in the waters of the Pacific, and that will affect where tuna are found.
Dr. Graham Pilling from the SBC, the Pacific Community, explains that the weather pattern over the Pacific Ocean controls the temperature of the water. And the temperature of the water dictates where the tuna will go.
El Niño conditions are associated with drier conditions, and La Niña conditions tend to be wetter and cooler. So that's what we kind of feel on the surface. But in the Pacific, it also influences how far warm waters, which are in the west of the Pacific, extend out towards the central area, towards Kiribati and places like that. And when it is extending out further east, that allows stocks like skipjack, who are much more preferring warmer conditions, to move further east in the Pacific and therefore be caught in the waters of places like Kiribati. When it's La Nina and that warm water is more constrained to the west, then you'll find them around Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea, for example.
Dr. Pilling, a key part of your job is modeling the future of how climate change might affect tuna. How does that work?
So we identify different scenarios for basically the greenhouse gas emissions that will drive climate change into the future. And that can be a good scenario where we stay below the Paris Agreement 2-degree change, or a poor scenario where greenhouse gases continue to be emitted at an increasing rate into the future, to try and kind of bracket what the futures will look like. We have oceanographic models which then give you an idea of what the temperature and other conditions will be in the Pacific. And on top of that, we layer our, if you like, an ecosystem model, which translates how that temperature change will drive the food fish of tuna and therefore the tuna themselves.
Under the more worrying scenario, if greenhouse gases continue to be emitted as they are now, what could we see happen?
So we're looking 25 years into the future as a kind of indicator of where things are going. And I guess the results so far suggest that two things, really. The abundance of tuna in the Pacific is going to decline, and if we look at our exclusive economic zones in the Western Central Pacific, on average, the decline will be about 13%. And also the majority of tuna are going to be found further east in the Pacific. I mentioned the Enzo cycle where El Nino conditions, you find tuna further east in the Pacific. That's going to become more of a common trend under these climate change models. General trend is warmer waters further to the east. Waters in the west may actually be a little too warm for tuna to be. And so you get this kind of movement towards the east.
And so how will that impact Pacific countries who rely on tuna fishing for their economies if tuna move east?
While the majority of tuna are caught currently within exclusive economic zones, the further east you go, the more onto the high seas you get, and that's outside EEZs, which under the current system would mean that members couldn't charge fishing vessels to access their waters, or their waters become less attractive to fishing vessels in the future under climate change.
How concerning is it for the region?
It's a pretty big issue, and it's a concerning issue, just given that importance of tuna for Pacific Island members. This is their key resource. This is a resource that they want to keep sustainably exploited so that they can keep getting the benefits from them. And having some external force like climate change having a potentially significant impact on their ability to do that is really, really significant. And that's one of the reasons we've been working towards this Green Climate Fund project, so that we can help our members try and understand what the changes will be and also try and adapt to them in advance of all these impacts really coming to bear in 2050.
The Green Climate Fund is the world's largest climate fund set up by the United Nations to help countries adapt to climate change. In February 2025, it announced a more than $100 million US dollar grant for 14 Pacific countries to help them manage the risk of climate impacts on tuna. Dr. Pilling, what will this funding help with?
Part of the work is looking at bringing in what we call fish aggregating devices, FADs, FADs, that are anchored near shore. What they do is, as the name suggests, attracts fish underneath them, and they kind of build up a small ecosystem, attracting small fish and then larger fish and then tuna that eat them. And that means that you're trying to capture your coastal tuna resource in a way that's much easier to catch. You take the pressure off the coastal resources and transfer them onto the more abundant tuna stocks so that people can have food for subsistence to sell in the local markets and things like that. And the other arm is, I mentioned that we're trying to improve our modeling to better understand what the implications are going to be at the local scale. And the second arm of this project is trying to develop a climate awareness, climate information system that can better predict what the impacts of climate change are going to be on tuna, and we can provide better advice to our membership in terms of what, when, and where the implications of climate change will be.
Dr. Pilling and his team at SBC, the Pacific Community, are locked in on the science of the Pacific's tuna stocks. And although the forecast is worrying, he says steps are being taken to try and mitigate this. The Pacific region has banded together in the last two decades to battle the threat of overfishing and put sustainable practices in place to ensure they have healthy stock. And Dr. Josie Tamate, the chair of the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission, says she believes the region will fight together again.
I think the cooperation has been the cornerstone for the success of the, especially the Pacific Island nation, the members of the FFA. The commitment is already there. It's how do we reach a decisions or measures that will be binding, but how do we work with those?
The Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission is a regional fisheries organization that is responsible for conserving and managing tuna in the Western and Central Pacific Oceans. 17 Pacific nations are members, along with countries like Australia, Canada, and China.
Tuna is highly migratory, and regional cooperation or even cooperation at the commission level is important because we can't escape it, eh? We are seeing the impact of it. The commission, agreed to it becomes a standing agenda item for the commission at the subsidiary bodies, which is the Northern Committee. They have to look at how would you incorporate climate change or how would you address climate change.
And Dr. Tamate says climate change is front and center as they look to the future.
We're supporting and incorporating the scientific research into the management discussions. And we're beginning all the processes to ensure the Pacific Island states in particular can maintain their economic benefits. And there's also the need for, the adapting existing management frameworks. Acknowledging there's still a lot of work, and especially if these fishes, the tuna would be moving eastward and out of the EEZs of the small island states, Pacific small island states, that is. So we're working within a very complex legal and geopolitical framework to pursue climate justice for tuna-dependent economies. And you're balancing sustainability, equity, and economic needs in the face of, profound climate-driven changes. So we can't escape it. It's here, and we need to find ways. And the Commission is really well and truly have taken this on board. If we do nothing now, that's not an option. We have to do something. Each of us have a responsibility. Whether you're a developing nation or a developed nation, we all have a responsibility because it's climate change is staring at us. We are experiencing it today.
But despite all the work planned at the regional level, from science and research to diplomatic cooperation, and the work at an individual country level, the fact remains that the Pacific contributes very little to global greenhouse emissions. And Dr. Pilling says, this isn't an issue for the Pacific, it's an issue for the world.
I think we all should be concerned. It's a global challenge, and to be effective, every country in the globe needs to be working towards the same goal. So I think it's a challenge if that isn't the case. And I think the scenarios that we've looked at suggest that if it isn't the case, then the impacts for tuna in the Pacific, and therefore for the fisheries and members of SPC, are going to be much greater than if the world were pulling together in the same direction.
It's a message Tuvalu politician Simon Kofe hopes the world takes to heart.
We see the disproportionate burden that we carry in the Pacific to manage this resource, which is important to the world. But unfortunately, the world doesn't see it in that way. But it's disappointing that we are dealing with a crisis that was not of our making.
He says the science and the real world impacts are clear. The fish in the Pacific Oceans are changing their patterns, and it's up to the world to respond before it's too late.
And we're seeing it right now. You see floodings taking places in different parts of the world, bushfires. I mean, we're setting new records for the hottest month in the year. We're seeing all these changes that are happening, and I just feel that the world might be too late when they finally take this issue seriously.
Polytalk is hosted by me, Scott Wyde. Our producer is Kunta Marie Crofts. Our supervising producer is Jordan Fennell. And our executive producer is Faleanga Fulu, Inga Stunzna.
Talo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.